welcome to First 7-Inch Club, episode 34, the big 34, Walter Payton of the Chicago Bears, if you guys remember. Sweetness, a.k.a. Sweetness. Each episode on First 7-Inch Club, we dig up a 7-inch by a forgotten or obscure band within the realms of hardcore, punk, and metal, and discuss whether or not they're worth being remembered. We also provide factoids and trivia that we glean from the internet and our own personal experiences. I think I should add sometime in the intro that we aren't actual experts, and we're actually kind of dumb when it comes to stuff. So if you are hoping for some hard-hitting facts and some concrete truths out of this podcast, maybe just use this as a guideline and do your own research, as some say, because we can be off the mark every once in a while. But I am Mike, and with me is Scott.
That's part of the fun of this. Like that, I think most of the listeners have gotten it. They get the gag.
Yeah,
they've written in that they think it's, you know, cool that we're fucking up in front of everybody.
Yeah. I only brought it up because Sawyer, the only person on earth that likes street trash, he was like, oh, you were wrong about this. And I was like, I don't fucking care, man. But it was something that I think I knew, and I must have just said it wrong. I didn't listen back, but I think I just said it wrong. So it's one of the very few moments where I actually did know something, and I just said it wrong. So I just need to put that in the front now, that we are actually dumb idiots.
Despite what you just heard, if you come to us with information and it's interesting, I'm happy to say it next episode. If it's funny, or if it's cool, or if it's not just pedantic bullshit, I think that's enriching. We will definitely say it next episode. Oh, we found out we were wrong about this and blah, 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 and here's whatever. But Mike, I didn't really watch the whole Super Bowl because I don't know much about football, but I did watch some of the commercials and the halftime show, and I'm very angry that one of the funniest things I've ever seen was used to sell me crypto. Because I thought the Larry David commercial was great. Yeah. It was like a whole bunch of Larry David given to you like an injection, like 30 seconds of powerful, powerful Larry David. And I was like laughing at it. And then at the end, they get to the end and it's crypto ad. And I wanted to fucking die. He just made us so happy like a month ago with his like MAGA hat thing. And then he's like trying to flip crypto on me now. And I feel terrible about it. We don't really have to, you know, talk about the Super Bowl much if you want. But I do want to say that I'm very glad 50 Cent is turning into Mark Henry. It's one of the nicest things I've ever seen, that he got that wide.
Yeah, he's bulking up, that's for sure. Bulking.
This week, Super 7, they dropped an action figure. And I'm a person who is, you know, badly awash in nostalgia. I can't get past nostalgia. I like to close my eyes, and I like to think about how the video for Do You Think I'm Sexy looks. You know, I like to think of how old TV looked, seeing Crystal Gale on terrible television shows and stuff like that, and how the lights used to look on old shows. And I like to think about Hawaiian Punch commercials. So I'm lost. There's no coming back for me. All I think about is old times, but I don't buy toys. I just don't buy them. At one point in my early adulthood, I thought I was going to be doing that shit. I was like in my 20s. I'm like, man, I'm making this money now. I'm going to finally get that Clash of the Titans Kraken. You know, I'm going to get all the Max Steel Robo Force. I'm going to get all those things, but I never did. I didn't want that shit around my house. So now I just sit in my study, scratching my chin and thinking, I think about Micronauts. But Super 7 figured me out. They nailed the one real life human person that I'd want to own in 3 3/4 inches. And that's Cliff Burton. They put out a Cliff Burton doll and I bought it. There's zero thought put into this thing. As far as I can tell, there's no inside jokes on the card. There's no references to, you know, should have been Lars. Nothing like that. He's got the base that I think most Joe Schmoes would not have chosen for him, even though it's accurate. And it looks nothing like him. But, you know, I think that works. That works because, like, 70s action figures, they usually didn't look like, you know, the guy. So that's fine. So, yeah, I paid too much and now I own this thing. We talked about this in the group and in the Discord and in the Facebook group. And I thought maybe you'd want to sit down with me and come up with a battle of lists if you want to do the top three metal, hardcore, or punk-related things that you'd like to see in toy form. Mike, are you up to this challenge?
Sure.
All right. Do you want to go first?
Yeah, I'll start. I have a little warning beforehand. My I buy toys. I have no bones about it. I'm old and dying. I might as well do the things that make me happy, which is own pieces of plastic. I'm not like a super crazy toy buyer, but if something tickles my fancy, I will buy it. And I've even gotten into more expensive toys, so I don't even scoff at that anymore. But I've always had this thing. Yeah, I've always had this thing where it has to be like some sort of fiction or fantasy. Mm-hmm. I have a problem with toys that are just people.
So you're judging me now. I just got here.
I'm just this is a preface to how my picks, because my picks are all going to be cop outs because. Gotcha. This is a real hard exercise for me because it's just like, it's not even like I own like a Norm from Cheers Mego, and that's fine because it's a guy playing a character. But if it's just like Cliff Burton, it's like, that's weird. Like I don't have no rhyme or reason to it. There's just like that disconnect because I've never been a big like fame person. I don't really look at famous people on the internet or anything like that. So just the idea of like seeing a doll of just a guy is just like preposterous to me for some reason. Makes no sense. So it's kind of hard for me to come up with just specific people because it's just even in my fantasies, I'll think about it and be like, this is dumb. I don't like this. And so it doesn't work. So all of my answers are cop outs. The first one is something that did exist in 2006. The McFarlane Toy Company made these 3D album covers. And they did it, Metallica, Master of Puppets, and then three albums, you know, only people in college dorms care about. It was like Led Zeppelin, Jimi Hendrix, and another one of those to complete the, the triumvirate. And, Master of Puppets these came out in 2006. I had no idea they existed until like, I don't know, probably 2010 when I saw the Master of Puppets one in a thrift store for like a dollar. And I was like, oh, I got to get that. And it's awesome. Like, I think when you say 3D album covers, if you don't look at it, you just think maybe just like a piece of plastic that's like, you know, raised. So there's like texture and stuff to the album cover. It's not like that at all. These have like, it's like, you know, kind of like a tiny toy set with like a background, a middle ground, and a foreground. And, you know, they put the appropriate things from the album cover on each plane. And, you know, then you look at it and you're like, whoa, that's cool. And it is. It's super cool. I think 2006 was a little ahead of its time because people were still buying actual music. And now people just buy things to remind them of music, like Cliff Burton dolls. So I imagine this failed. I don't know what they retailed at. I imagine they were probably at least $20. And I could see why they failed, because outside of Master of Puppets, it was like the three most basic bitch records ever, and who's going to buy that?
Yeah, they did a Nevermind the Bullocks, which is just text on a yellow background.
Yeah. But, I mean, there's a lot of awesome metal records out there. Like, imagine a Morbid Angel Altars of Madness like this. Like, there's just so many amazing death, like any Death album cover, like any of that stuff. I thought they did a Megadeth, but I guess they didn't. But, any of that stuff would be amazing. So even if it was just metal of these 3D album covers, like I said, I think it was a little ahead of its time. I think if they sold these right now, they would go fucking bananas. They would sell like hotcakes. So McFarlane, I know you're a big listener of First 7-Inch Club.
Yeah.
I'm telling you, you gotta really re-release these 3D album covers, because they would be a hit with more fringe genres of music, I think.
Yeah. He came on because of a Captain America chat. You heard that we're getting to the real shit. So my first one, I'm going to knock out real quick, only because I said it online and I hate when people can find me saying the same thing twice, but this is an important one. So I'm going to take the risk, but I really want a Sean McCabe doll, Sean McCabe from Mick and Dagger. I want him in corpse paint with literally any accessories. You know, you can make him have corpse paint and not like give him the Zartan face so he could take off his corpse paint if you want. Give him wooden stakes and bats. I don't care. Barfed on Bibles is my choice, and a burning Christmas tree. It's easy to do. And since Toy Box is supposedly dropping that Crud as a Cult box set, that's supposed to be sometime this decade, I think. There's never been a better time. Just do a whole Ink and Dagger set. Do the whole set, because then you could do Eric Wareheim and he'd probably like choke on his wine and his caviar and his fugu tartare while he's on his yacht. He would choke to death.
There's tons of those people that just take like a Playmobil doll and just paint it a little and put it in a cool packaging for $60. So you could pay somebody like that to do like a small run of 50 of these Sean McCabe figures for your set. That's how what's his face start? I forget. It's all toy people, but there's a guy, I'm forgetting his name now, but he's like a huge toy guy that just started out by doing that, and so it works out. Retro Band started out doing that, just making like small run 20 dolls, and now he's a big deal. My next one is, I am a sucker for blind boxes. I think blind boxes always get me if it's something that's interesting. And I think you mix blind box with the old 90s Quarter Machine, Stars, the homies, and you kind of make different blind box series of different like group like it's like scene stereotypes basically, like do like a youth crew volume of just like you know, hooded man with no face, X'd up man jumping, you know, guy looks like a jock, you know, all that kind of youth crew imagery, put that in a blind box. You do New York hardcore and have like a Vinny Stigma in there. You do emo and have like a bunch of wimps. You know, metal obviously is an easy one. You do like whatever you call like people listen to Torch and just like a bunch of fat dudes in black shorts. Like yeah, you have a chase in each series. This I like. There's no way anybody would fund this, but to a certain group of people, this is just a lock for money. I shouldn't even be saying this on air because this is my $1 million idea to get me out of this hellhole. Yeah. I should just be manufacturing these things.
Yeah, you covered. We don't even need to do the rest of the list because everybody. Because one of my other ideas was the mysterious hooded straight edge guy with the Mac 10 or whatever.
Yeah,
you know, you can have the racist variant where he's like, yeah, like that would be perfect. So Mike, you may be surprised to know this. I don't know if we've ever discussed it. Even though the first 7-inch club as an entity disrespects old punk, I'm actually a big fan of the Damned. And Mike, I don't know if you know or care about the Damned, but they are famously four different weird punk characters, almost like the Young Ones or something. Like there was like four archetype guys. Like they were made for a Saturday morning cartoon or something. And the singer, Dave Vanian, actually lives as a Dracula. He lives life, and he's lived life for 50 years or whatever now he lives. So when they interview him, it's always by candlelight and stuff, and he always looks gaunt. He always has his widow's peak. He wears like frilly outfits in public. He's a Dracula. He just lives as a Dracula all the time, as far as I know. And in the 80s, he grew out his hair, this like luscious long hair with like a white streak in it, like he's a vampire Lestat.
I remember that.
Big fan of that. So what I want is a Barbie head so I can comb Dave Vanian's 80s vampire hair with the gray streak. I want one of those Barbie heads. So now we're two for two. Two of my picks are vampires.
So my last one, I should have did this in the middle because I think the homies one was the big closer. But there's an guy, a doll maker, I guess you would call him, a toy maker, an artist that I like, named Jim Chan. I guess the brand is Chubby Cheeks. And he does Chubby Chunk, maybe. I guess it depends. I think Chubby Chunk is his Instagram. And I guess he's Jim Chan, aka Jim Dreams, on the internet. And what he does is he takes a lot of mascots for food and fast food and turns them into big fat sleeping babies or just big fat babies. Sometimes drooling and stuff like this. He did a Jollibee one a couple years ago of the Jollibee bee just being like a little fat baby and sleeping and drooling on itself.
Yeah,
and I was like, this is my favorite toy artist ever. And so I bought that. He did some blind boxes. He did a blind box set of all other fast food mascots, and I bought all those. And I think this would be the thing to get me to buy like metal and music mascots, I think, is if we got Jim Dreams to turn all of them into fat babies, like Eddie from Iron Maiden into like a fat sleeping baby, all those the fucking guy from Megadeth, and then I think this would not only get me into metal, but it would definitely get me to buy these things too. So I just need fat crying or sleeping babies of all famous metal mascots.
As a Funko Pop hater, I approve of that. It's just far enough away from this band has a lot of visuals you could easily make into toys, but I'm piggybacking off of your idea, because when I saw that Master of Puppets thing, I was like, you know what I want? I want my favorite record cover of all time, which is Creators Out of the Dark into the Light. It's my favorite painting. It looks like Benicio del Toro coming up out of blood. The face looks it looks just like him. He's just emerging from blood, and it's like a real 70s, like almost Conan looking painting. And by the artist who did all the creator's work. So the thing is, the guy who did all those paintings emerged on the internet a few years back. I think his name is Philip Lavier. Philip Lavier. He emerged on the internet a few years back bitching just bitching because he, you know, he said that when he did all those paintings that he was a punk and he was super punk and didn't want money. And so he never got money and he thinks Creator got rich. Creator. He thinks Creator got super rich off of his work and now they owe him big time. And so first of all, I want one of those Todd Toys 3D heads. So now I want two vampires and two heads. And I would have been fine seeing that guy get all the money. Like, this is how you can pay him back. We'll make something and he can just do that. So I looked him up, and since he stopped bitching about Creator, now he's become a full-on dipshit right-wing anti-vaxxer who makes songs. He makes songs backing the Canadian truckers and shooting down the vax and all that. So now I want the whole check to go to Millie Petrozza from Creator so he can get super rich and keep not paying Phil a dime till the end of time.
Well, I think that's perfect. Before I go into my spiel, just to get it out of the way, you can find us for 7-Inch Club, all letters, on Instagram, on YouTube, for 7-Inch Club at Gmail. You can go to our dying Facebook group. Just to type in First 7-Inch Club into Facebook. It'll pop up. First 7-Inch Club on Twitter. There's actually a link tree now in the Instagram bio. So you can just go to the Instagram bio and find all of our pertinent links. But
our OnlyFans.
Yeah. Find our OnlyFans.
Spicy content.
But yeah, if you need to get a hold of us, if you want to make a request or whatever, you know how to find us. Just go over there, that link tree, and figure it out.
I'd like to thank Alexander in the group for trying. He keeps posting like little curio threads, and they're fun. They're decent. He's trying. He's doing his best. So if anybody else wants to jump in and bail him out, he's doing all the work right now.
He's been listening to our bullshit for a long time, so he knows the deal. But
yeah,
I think I don't think a lot of our older listeners and stuff really carried over to this project.
Yeah.
I think we're on our own for this one. So it's a lot of new people. But first thing is, Scott, let's see how good your memory is. I want to bring you back to about 1986, 1987. There was a commercial for a new toothpaste technology called the Colgate pump. And it had a very famous known Scott influence commercial. Do you remember this commercial?
Scott is in music?
Yeah, it goes, "We got the Colgate pump. We got the Colgate pump. It's a neat new chick in a pump. It's on your brush and gum. We got the Colgate pump. She's got the Colgate pump. Even mom's a dad's a fan. What makes it good is MFP. Just the squirts of minty gel protection teeth that you can tell. We've got the Colgate pump. Nope. Okay,
this is definitely Madness. It's not by Madness.
Madness was the only ska band that I think the American knew, so it made sense. Yeah. But so now that I jog your memory, and hopefully maybe the audience will hear a clip of this, because you're probably not as old as us. but Scott, do you think? Because you're about that age. I don't know. You're probably 10 or 11 or something like that. Do you think this either consciously or subconsciously influence you into liking ska music at a later age?
No, I think there was enough time. I think there was enough time between 1986 and when I started for me to have forgotten the Colgate.
I don't know though. It's what I mean. You're like me. I watch a lot of commercials, and I'll just something. I'll hear like a commercial jingle from 1985, and it'll like bring back a memory. So
yeah.
I don't like. I want to. I make a lot of hot takes on podcasts. That's my thing.
Yeah.
And like a lot of bad ones, but I want to make the hot take that I think this commercial might have influenced a lot of young kids.
Yeah.
Maybe subconsciously to create third wave ska, the worst kind of music there is. I think the Colgate pump commercial really. I don't know. I think it fast-tracked that happening. So
it could be because this is authentic. So when you when people go to watch this, they're wearing checkerboard clothing. They're wearing suits. They're definitely like two-tone rude boy and rude girls doing the dance. They're doing the Madness dances.
Yep.
It's meant to be Madness. I don't know if they wrote it or not, but it's clearly meant to be invoking Madness. And it's meant to be invoking a Madness song that you probably hadn't heard yet. Because everyone was into Our House, which was a pop song, and not a lot of people were listening to like One Step Beyond and stuff like that, even though those songs were known. So yeah, this could be. I'll tell you this. When we all got into ska in 91, 92, like when it started happening, everybody was peering back through their lives to figure out where there was more ska. It was like a it was a very popular activity to go, oh, wait a minute, like this song was ska and that song was ska. And some people knew. Some people like were rude boys or whatever and knew about Two Tone and knew about old Skatalites and stuff like that. But a lot of people were just idiots like me who owned a Boss Tones tape and liked Fishbone and like thought we were ska dudes. And yeah, we're like, oh my God, that song was like The Tide Is High. The Tide Is High is a ska song. Did you know? Yeah. So it's legit. This is legit concern. I'll take it.
That's it. That's it, guys. If you want to know the origins of all the horrible third wave ska, look, just search Colgate pump commercials. The first one that pops up. So
yeah,
there you go. Next one is, this is just something I wanted to talk about, and I don't really have an end point to this, but I was alerted. If you guys are new listeners or you don't know my deal, Scott lives in upstate New York near Albany, and I used to live up there, and I don't live there anymore, but even after I moved out, I lived in New York City and for about 10 years. So I still frequented Albany. So, even if I wasn't in the thick of things, in the thick of what's going down in the streets of Albany, I was still there enough to keep up and still have friends. And I mean, I still have friends that are there, but I could see them more often and stuff like that. So I would still get the 411 and all the things happening. And then I moved to Chicago for going on 4 years now. And, I can't just, get on a bus and go to Albany for the day when you lived in Chicago. So I'm kind of shut out. My friends are older too. So a lot of them are going to shows or doing stuff like that. So there's really no hot goss for me anymore for Albany. And I feel disconnected because I don't really search it out because I'm just so disconnected. I'm no longer relevant. You know, there's probably people who were tiny children when I fucking moved out of Albany. So like it's just, and those are the people that go to shows and make bands now. So what's the matter? So I don't hear things and I don't really pay attention, but it does delight me when I do get some news every once in a while. And I was alerted by some people, a couple people. There is a burgeoning cowboy scene in upstate New York and Troy, right outside of Albany, in Troy, New York. And so me and like Scott said earlier, we hate old punk. We hate what I like to call equalizer punk, which is there is basically something happened where every punk kid after 1990 saw the same clip of Fair on SNL and the same episode of The Equalizer and was like, this is punk rock. We got to dress like this. And they didn't realize that that was like cosplay, but it is. It's cosplay. But as much as I hated that stuff, there's no class or no like regional ties to how punk people dress. You can be young or old. You could be rich or poor, black or white. It doesn't matter. You can put on a leather jacket and tie a bandana around your knee and be punk. There's no classifications. A cowboy, however, is a lot of classifications. for one, you can't live in upstate New York. That's the big one. That's the big one. It's not a place.
You would think.
It's not a place known for their cowboys. It's one of the like that whole area, like New York, upstate New York to Massachusetts to New Hampshire. That whole area, no cowboys. It's not even. You know, it's just impossible for them to live. It's not the climate for the cowboys. And I know I'm not an idiot. I'm not a dummy. We did the whole episode about it in the old podcast. But I know Orville Peck has, you know, stirred a lot of feelings in people about making that money. And, you know, it's like, oh, Orville Peck, he's an ex-punk in from Canada. And he became a famous country star. But, you know, not actual country, just a cool hip country. But yeah. Canada is like 90% wilderness, so it's like it makes sense. Like you can be a cowboy in Canada, I believe. I think that's a thing.
Yeah.
Even though he's obviously not a cowboy, he's a punk dude. But it's just like it is a strange place, and it's the first thing I've heard that connected me with Albany, where I was like, oh my God, I miss this stupidity so much, because it's just like, it's just a tough thing to pull off to be like, listen, man. I'm a cowboy. I am a cowboy that lives.
I want to be a cowboy.
I'm a cowboy. I love country music. And I live in a place where it's literally buried under 20 inches of snow for 9 months out of the year. And I'm rustling the cattle. I'm doing whatever I need to do. I'm just trying to get by. I don't know. So I have my ear to the streets now because I want to see how long this lasts, because it doesn't seem sustainable to me to be a cowboy in Albany, because I was talking, I don't know if it was you or somebody else, like the person who told me, but I was talking to somebody about how, like, in New York, when I lived in New York, there's a famous, like, honky-tonk bar there, and it was, like, hip, and it was just like, oh my god, it was fucking packed every night, Tom Hanks is there, this guy's there, like, it's just, like, this big thing. But the thing with New York is that it's, like, no one is from New York that, like, no one was born and raised in New York. It's, like, people from all over the place. So it makes sense. When you are a Midwesterner or a Westerner or a Southerner or something, and you move into New York City and you're like, oh, this place is for me. And then it's like a fun place, and there's, you know, it makes sense. But Albany, it's kind of tough to pull that off. So I don't know how sustainable this is. I hope it works out. I hope it's like, that John Travolta movie, Urban Cowboy.
You got it. Rhinestone Cowboy and Urban Cowboy with a bomb, the two.
Okay.
Neutron bombs that hit pop culture in the same
time. Yeah. I don't know if these cowboys and Troy have seen those movies, but maybe watch those and see how you can pull it off. It's been a while. I don't know if it worked. I don't know if it was good for Northeastern cowboys or not, if it worked out. But I just have some advice. I didn't know that there's like a Mexican kind of Western scene in Chicago. Yeah. In the Midwest, and I went to one of their stores called Alcala's Western Wear, and it's in the actual city of Chicago, and it is the coolest Western Wear store I've ever been to. So you promising young cowboys out in upstate New York, Google Alcala's Western Wear, because they have some really good clothes, and you'll look the part a little more. You'll look really cool. But congratulations to all of you young cowboys out there. I hope nothing but the best for you.
I just want to push back. Upstate New York has a rich history of people cosplaying as cowboys all the way back to when I was a kid, because the urban cowboy thing really took here. My whole family grew up on country music and all that stuff. And my grandfather died being a country music fan. He's like super, super into it. I don't know the whole backstory, but I know that my mom and her sisters used to go to a bar called Remington's that had a mechanical bull. Remington's bar was like the place in Colony, New York for single ladies and gentlemen to meet up. It was a whole thing. So, but then, you know, then there's what, 30 years of space between then and now, where it became more, you know, it became kind of like the coal rolling MAGA hat guys became the holders of the country, the sword of country. And how do they're taking it back, and more power to them, I guess. You know, as I've said numerous times, I'm a shame-based person. I don't like to be noticed when I'm out and about, so I dress down. I'm a gray man. I don't want to be seen. I've even demetalled my shirts. I don't really want someone to come up and talk to me about like suffocation or anything. I just don't want that chat at Stewart's. So, you know, I've gotten rid of it all. So the fact that these guys go out, they do it full time, as far as I could tell, which is amazing to me.
Full time cowboys. They're just rustling the cattle, just waking up and
walk around Troy, New York.
Well, we get in their cowboy suits. Tending to the wheat or whatever. Yep. Rustling up those cattle.
So in my cloud of shame, I salute them, because they're living their interest, their current interest.
Yeah.
I don't know how long it'll last, but if they, you know, if they stick with it, country music in the Capital District has a boom and bust cycle of about 30 years, guys. So if it doesn't take now, by the time you're 50 or 60, you get another shot.
I do want to know, though, because this has to be the Orville Peck influence. It's not.
Yeah.
It doesn't just come up one day where you're like, oh yeah, I love horses. I love riding horses. That doesn't happen. So people out there from different parts of the country, let me know if there's a new burgeoning cowboy scene in your area that does not really allow cowboys. Like, is there a...
If you guys want to give me your cowboy scene report, tell me how they dress, what they're up to, how realistic it is, and if any of them ever have contact with a cow or a horse, give us the report, and we're happy to read it.
The record tonight is by a band called Farkas Affair, or aka The Farkas Affair, but I think it's just Farkas Affair. This is a self-titled 7-inch on Reservoir Records from 1995. Farkas Affair was a band from Long Island, New York, And they had this in a split 7-inch with a band called, I almost said Seinfeld 65, which would have been a great name, but it's actually Sinatra 65. This was actually requested or recommended by Jeff from End on End podcast, and we talked about him before. He was in Judas Iscariot and a bunch of other bands, and mm-hmm. he wrote us some emails shedding some light on all the stuff we got wrong. And he shouted us out. He gave us a little nice scene report about us on his the last episode of End on End podcast about Nation mm-hmm. of Ulysses. And you know, he talked about how we don't know what the fuck we're talking about, and you know, it's good. But no, Jeff, I actually reached out to Jeff because he requested this, and I was like, oh, I'll hit you up, because I actually already own this record. I didn't listen to it yet. I just bought it in one of my sprees of buying records for the show. And then he requested it, and I was like, oh, I already own that. So I was like, I'll hit you up when we do it. So I get some facts. And then he was like, no, it would probably be better if, you know, you just did it off your head, because that's more entertaining. And then I emailed him to tell him we're doing it. He's like, if you really want some facts. And I was like, no. Well, I didn't even say no. I didn't reply because I'm a horrible person. So I, sorry, Jeff, I did not reply, but I decided to do it off the dome. Little did I know, this was before I really looked at the record, and the fact that there's no info. There is the littlest info we have ever had to go on a fucking record.
Yeah.
There's no insert. As far as I know, it didn't come with an insert. We'll get into it when we talk about the layout, but there's little info on the back, but it's impossible to read. It's not a good layout. It is impossible to read. The Discogs doesn't have any real info. Luckily, we had a couple things to go on. First, their drummer was a very famous kind of New York area drummer named Vinnie Value, who unfortunately passed away a couple years ago. He was in many, many bands. He was in No Redeeming Social Value. He was in Kill Your Idols. Gray Area, which was a big one. I think those were his, Warzone, and he was in this band, and probably even some more that aren't on his Discogs page, but he was in many, many known New York hardcore bands. But outside of that, there was not much info. Luckily, Jeff tipped us off and said that he was in a band with Eric from Farkas Affair. So I did some snooping and figured out Eric, because it's not, you know, there's no Eric on the Farkas Affair Discogs, but I looked it up. Eric, he was in other bands. The band he's in with Jeff is a band called Too Many Voices, which has been around for about 10 years. And oddly enough, they put their demo out on RTF Records, which is a friend of mine, Pat. So that was a little, some small world shit, because, mm-hmm. you know, I don't, you know, I didn't know these guys even knew Pat. And so that's kind of weird. So, but he was in Too Many Voices. He is in Too Many Voices. He was in a band called The Last Crime. He was in a band called the Del Bombers, and there was at least one guy, it was probably Eric or Vinny, one of these guys was in another Long Island band called the 52X, which was, I think, like kind of like a jokey type band, judging by their song titles. And that's it. Either I don't know the one or two other, or the two or three other mystery people in Farkas Affair. I couldn't figure out anything out. It's possible some of them may or may not have been also in Garden Variety. I know they have a connection to them somehow, because I want to say somebody in the 52X was in Garden Variety. And
the drummer.
And it might have been the same guy. I couldn't connect the dots. So, and this band, spoiler alert, sounds a lot like Garden Variety. So it's, you know, I think they might have shared members. I don't know. So that's all I found. I actually tried hard. I mean, there's a couple interviews you could find I think there's one with Too Many Voices on No Echo. I didn't read the whole thing, but I think if you wanted to get deep, I don't, because that's more Scott's territory to get deep and juicy in there. but that's all like the base info I found.
You know, I think we knew from Jeff's email that a guy named Kevin McManus was in the band. And he was in a band I liked back in the day, sort of, called Dahlia Seed.
Okay. I missed that. I suck at reading emails, but yeah, I remember Dahlia Seed.
Yeah.
Silver record. One of their records was silver, right? Am I remembering that right?
Yeah. It was cool. I mean, I liked Dahlia Seed back then because, you know, they answered the question we all had, which is, what if Ashes was a little better? And what if... what if they started shouting once in a while and it was exciting, you know? And I also, I think that band also had members of Black Army Jacket.
Yeah.
Or, you know, some crossover Black Army Jacket. Eryx Viridia, the guy you talked about, who is in Too Many Voices, is currently like the kind of guy who combs his hair and plays a Telecaster with an upright bass in the band, which usually is something that we also disrespect on the first 7-inch club. But, you know, he's not a cowboy in Troy, so I think I'm going to let it slide. I think he looks good doing it. So, you know, that's cool. I couldn't unlock the other guy. There's one guy in the band I just couldn't unlock. I don't know. He looks familiar, but I don't know what he does. I assume he's got to be the singer. Aside from that, if you delete the drummer who has the resume of ages, because he's a drummer, of course, typically huge drummer resume, there's still crazy overlap in this band with so many other bands. One of the dudes was in a band called Last Crime.
Yep.
And that has the singer from Beyond. Beyond is the band that gave us post-hardcore. Like, they're the band that had Alan Cage and, you know, all the guys who were in later bands like Quicksand and stuff. All, like, they got the idea from Youth of Today taking the band Beyond out on the road with them or whatever. So that's a lot. Just having that guy alone in one of your bands, like, wow, it's kind of weird. He's like some kind of legendary creature moving among them or something like that. But No Echo is the hotspot for all the chat about this band, but no one ever gives you anything direct. And I put all the names we had in the blender to see if you get anything from combining their names. Like, you know, Eric's radio was in a band with this guy. Nothing. There's nothing. The internet is dead silent about this band that everybody remembers. Everybody who gives an interview about the Long Island scene will go, oh yeah, there was this band, that band, and Farkas Affair, and blah, 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 blah. But nobody ever gets specific about it, other than the label guy actually talked about him a little bit in one interview, but he doesn't say much. So, very difficult research project, Jeff. Thank you for making us look like assholes.
And so I was not familiar with this band, but I am familiar with Reservoir Records. This was a label started by Andrew Orlando, who was also in Black Army Jacket. And they had, like, I mean, for me, I mostly remember they released the legendary CR. I think they released all their stuff, but mainly the John Lisa LP, which was, as Scott can guarantee and assure you, was hot in the streets in 1996. Yeah. This was... I don't know what it was about this, because I think you listen to it now and you'll be like, what the fuck? But this was like a hot crossover record to all different kinds of scenes in, at least in, you know, the New York, the Northeast area. I don't know how far it reached out there, but I mean, what it sounds like is mostly like kind of like a, what people would call power violence. And I think maybe it's just because that sound didn't really work its way over here yet. So maybe that's why everybody was enamored with it. But, you know, it was just one of those bands that everybody loved. So they put that out. They put out the Black Army Jacket stuff, including Black Army Jacket Newthrush, which Newthrush was one of those bands where I was like, this is slow and gross. I love this. Newthrush Corrupted, one of the strangest, weirdest, slow, doomy kind of bands I've ever seen. Gave me a panic attack seeing them. So they're up there. They put Jesuit out. Early Pig Destroyer, Silent Majority. Not the big Silent Majority hit record, but they did put out the early Silent Majority. Doc Hopper. They put out a Garden Variety split. A lot of very like kind of well known legendary Northeast area stuff. And they're around from 93 to 98 or 93 to 99. And put out most of the stuff, you know, a lot more hits than misses. Most of the stuff definitely worth going out of your way and listening to.
Yeah, this is like a solid discography.
Yeah.
There's some poppier stuff in the mix, and it's like the bummer kind of rainy day pop punk stuff that I don't have any time for it, and it makes me really feel 90s in the bored way. like I don't like Doc Hopper. I don't like smoking popes or any of that kind of like dreary pop punk. But you know, people let us know. Was CR huge everywhere? Because they were the, I don't know what it was, but everybody was talking about CR. And it was so strange because there was nothing about them that was, had any crossover potential whatsoever. No. Like they had more, you know, I guess emotion stuff going on than the goofy, they weren't spaz, but they were definitely as heavy as any of those kind of bands. They put out a bunch of Hell No. They put out the Spaz. Did you say the Spaz Monster X split?
I missed that one.
That was awesome. Nothing's Quiet in the Eastern Front is a great comp. It had a couple Albany bands on it. And that Jesuit 7-inch slaps. It's one of my favorite records That was like the heaviest thing I think I'd ever heard in 96. I think it still holds up. I just listened to it before the show and I was like, everybody who wanted a follow-up to Dead Guy, they'd do it probably better. They were so violent and heavy and crazy, and it still sounds really heavy and great now. But yeah, if I had briefly done this label when I was a young man and then quit, I'd be proud that I'd done this. It's good job.
Yeah. So it's weird this band kind of missed me. Like, I remember hearing the name. Obviously, this is a, if you guys don't know, this is a Christmas Story reference. I know America has retconned A Christmas Story into being evil again somehow, and everybody pretends like it's this awful movie, but there's a reason it's on 24 Hours a Day on Christmas, and it's because it's the best Christmas movie. So Farkas is the bully Scott Farkas, or Scut Farkas, as some say, that like I used to say. And the name Farkas Affair, there's another band also called The Farkas Affair, but they spell it, the band we're talking about, spells it F-A-R-K-C-U-S. And I think, you know, any remedial English would teach you, it should be F-A-R-C-K-U-S. And I didn't do my research. I don't know if that's how they spell it in The Christmas Story, or if they were aware of the other Farkas Affair and they were like, well, they're going to probably invent Google in a couple of years, and then no one will be able to find us on the internet. So we got to change it up. I don't know. But either way, there's another band called Farkas Affair. But yeah, so I remember the name, but I just never got around to listening to them. So we'll talk about the layout. The layout is very simple. Like I said, there's no insert. The back is a texture, and I think this is a little pre-Photoshop, so I think this is an actual photo or something, very high-def photo at the time. It might even be a painting. I'm colorblind, but it looks to me like it could either be green moss or like mold, or it could be a delicious cake. It could be a really close-up picture of delicious cake. It also, now I'm looking at it very closely, this might just be a painting, but at first I just thought it was like disgusting dirt. The back is the kind of the same deal, but it's a more of a maroon red color. It almost looks like if you put a microscope to a rug and you're just like, this is a dirty rug. There is actually print on the backside, but I can't read it because of my debilitating handicap called color blindness, but it could barely make it out. It's like a typewriter font, and that's about all you get. There's a label on the inside, and it just has pictures of the guys in it. It's odd. It's very, very odd to include pictures of yourself and not put like who's in the band. That, like, I could accept the no insert thing pissed me off beyond all belief when I was a kid, because it would just be like, oh man, I bought this, I don't have anything to read, like I don't know anything about these guys, it's fucking weird. But I could accept no insert, no band member names, fine. You want to be mysterious or whatever, or maybe you just forgot, or maybe the insert didn't come in time and then they just sold the records anyways. But including your pictures and not including names is very weird. That is very, very weird move. But anyways, looking at this kind of, you know, whatever kind of cover where it doesn't really give you any hints, I was expecting this to be more in the line of the power violence side of Reservoir Records. So I will say it doesn't really convey what this music actually sounds like, and I was very surprised when I put on the record.
Yeah, maybe it's a flex because, you know, Long Island is one of those scenes where everybody knows and remembers everything. So they could just say, hey, here's our picture, you know who we are, we're the Farkas Affair, you know what the fuck's up. Something like that. The cover, I have to wonder if the medium was important. Like, you know, like Metallica Load looks dumb, and then you find out it's Serrano's Blood and Cum, and then it's really dumb. That's I kind of wonder if this is something like that, because it looks natural. It looks almost like they made it by growing a fungus around the words or pouring slime over some like paper letters or something. And it also, if you look quick, it almost looks like a Necrolord painting from a 90s black metal album. It looks like in the Nightside Eclipse or something like that. It is green, to allay your mystery, Mike. It is like a very off-putting, not delicious cake green. And the back to me looks almost like a bad choice of kitchen counter with gross wads of hair or burlap on it. Like, because there's what makes it look like carpet is that there's the type is on these little pieces of some kind of natural, really unpleasant natural fiber that's been squished. And the one thing I'll give them a lot of credit. They get a lot of extra credit. You know why? Because they put A and B on the record, clearly marked sides A and B on the record itself. So score big, guys. You did great.
Yeah. Okay, we can get into the music. This is three tracks, so not quite full sound, but they're lengthy songs. The odd three track where you put two tracks on side A and one track on side B, meaning you really got to make those two songs on side A really stick out, because who wants to flip a record for a shitty song? So there's a solid possibility that third song never gets heard. So
yeah.
The first track is called Blessings. This isn't what I expected as soon as I put this on. This is, I guess, mathy, as Scott a couple weeks ago was helping me find the definition for the word technical when it comes to death metal, because it differs from what I think it should. But he said hardcore people would use the term mathy.
Yeah, I think so.
I think this is a little mathy or emo rock. Definitely not what I was expecting. It also has like a very nostalgic sound to me, but it's very strange because it has a nostalgic sound of the early 2000s, and this record was released in 1995.
Yeah.
Pretty spooky stuff.
Yeah.
It's these guys were, I don't want to say they're ahead of their time, but they were ahead of this sound being popular, that's for sure.
Yes.
Because I think Garden Variety predates them, and I'll get that out of the way now. Like I said, I think these guys had some connection with Garden Variety, if it was just really influencing them or what. Garden Variety is a band that, I don't know what their popularity is now, but at the time it was, they're a fairly popular band. They're always a landmine band to me because people would say they were good, and I thought their logo was cool, but their name was Garden Variety, which did not sound hard at all to me. So I kind of stayed away, and to be honest, it's something I hated back then. Like now I'm fine with this music, but back then this was too wimpy for me. But
yeah.
They do sound like Garden Variety. I'll say that I think, and maybe it's just the Garden Variety I've heard, but I think Garden Variety had a little more pop sensibility. I think this is Fargus Fair is a little more rugged than Garden Variety.
Mm-hmm.
But I, you know, like I said, it could just be what I heard. But this definitely sounds like something from Long Island. Like if you told me, if you just put this on and you said, "Where do you think these guys are from?" Long Island would be my first answer. So
yeah,
they got that down. This is not a good recording. This sucks. This is a fucking shit recording. This, I checked my needle 100 times to make sure there's no dust on it. This sounds awful. Like, it's the one guitar, the fuzzier guitar, just sounds like if a Nintendo had to replicate the sound of an electric guitar. It's very bad. And, this recording really hinders this band. Like, really, really badly hinders this band.
Yeah.
These songs are like begging for a better recording, and maybe it's, I don't think it's like, I don't, I really don't think it's the actual recording. I think it might be the mastering, or maybe it's just cheap vinyl. I don't know, because it's usually like cheap recordings sound like shit where you can't even make out anything, but you could make out every instrument on this, like clearly.
Yeah.
And so I don't know what's going on. I do think this was recorded live to tape, so that maybe that was, that had something to do with it. But it's not a good recording. There's some drifting dual vocals on this where the one guy sings, and that's where I don't think it's like technically a bad recording, because like they come, you know, there's like a crossfade effect when the dual vocals come in. And if this was a shit recording, I don't think they would have bothered with stuff like that. So I don't know what the deal is. But the dual vocals sound cool, and it's just used for a brief second, and I think it's used in a brief second in another song too. They should have really used that power more often, because
yeah,
I think that's really cool. I've been kind of not really mentioning how much I actually do like this song though. I really like this song. It really like cracked a code for me, because I can't really define what kind of what I like to call wimpier music I do enjoy. It's very hard for me to define. But I think this connected the dots for me, where I like stuff that's catchy but not poppy.
Yeah.
And I think it's hard to master that. I think it's hard to make something catchy. And I think that's why I like Quicksand so much, because I think they are the ultimate band that kind of mastered that technique and then wanted a little more bigger piece of the cake and kind of ruined it afterwards. But, you know, the one record they fucking mastered being catchy and not poppy. I think it's really tough. I think this song is, even though I it didn't sound like I was gushing over, this is like a 5-star song for me. I think the song, despite the bad recording, is like exactly my shit as far as kind of a more emo rock sound goes. I think this is a perfect track.
Well, my first guitar was a Synsonics headless, a flying V kind of shape that was purchased at Service Merchandise. I was a small boy. Very inexpensive. It was made of such inexpensive metal that it was pulling itself apart. The screws were actually making it explode while I was playing it. Just existing was too much for this guitar. And it came with a free amp. That blew up, and my mom bought me a little gorilla amp. It has a little picture of a gorilla on it. Awesome. An awesome little drawing of a gorilla on it. And that had a switch marked tube stack, which was groundbreaking for me. I had no idea that you had to do this, but I flicked that switch, and it distorted your guitar. But it sounded exactly like this record. These guys recorded this record on my old GG25 with the tube stack switched all the way on, and it sounds very fuzzy and cheap. But I really think it's limited to the guitars, because the other instruments kind of sound okay. But the garden variety thing is there, but a lot of my experience with garden variety is that some records were way more poppy than others, and I really didn't like the ones that were more poppy. So I just never liked the band at all. But this reminded me a little bit more of the early Shift stuff. Because it's kind of hovering in that same middle ground between the dreary chords and the heavy post-hardcore stuff. But my complaint about Shift was always that the vocalist was in over his head. Like, he wasn't in the range he was trying to sing in. And he did that all the way through his whole career, because they did another band called Big Collapse.
Yeah.
Same vocals. He never gave up trying to sing in Walter's range, basically. This band kind of sounds like if Shift had hired Walter. The Walter Schreifels gets hired by the band trying to sound like Walter Schreifels, which is a dream come true, because I think that this singer is kind of closer to that range than the Shift guy. I love this bassist. I love what he's doing. He's going bananas. He's got this over the top. He's got his right hand as a hammer. He's going dun 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 dun. He's punching his bass. And if I heard this when I was 19, this would have probably been my favorite song of 1995, just because this bassist is going crazy, and so was I. I was a young bassist going crazy.
Next track is called Let It Hang. Mentioned there was no inserts, so there's no lyrics, so I'm just gonna imagine the song is about not wearing underwear. The vocals are deep enough in there where I can't make them out. I couldn't decipher what this guy was saying.
I didn't
mention that. That's another thing that's exactly my shit, is unskilled singers that sing like they're skilled. That's what this guy is. Excuse me. This song is a grower, not a shower. It starts off, and you're just kind of like, this isn't the last song. Maybe we should go back to the last song. But after a few listens, the song grew on me, and I was into it. But I don't think it's as powerful as the last song. It's not immediate where I'm like, I need to hear everything. But it's still good. This was a song that would definitely, I mean, I could say that about all these tracks, but this would definitely benefit from a better sound or better production. I think this gets a little muddier where it should be very bright, and it's not. I wrote this down, and maybe now the Scott Shift's comparison made my comparison obsolete, and I think he's more spot on. But I did think this sounded like a little proto Thursday. I don't know if Thursday were fans of Garden Variety or Farkas Affair, but I think this is a little proto. But kind of like what Scott said, where the heavier post hardcore stuff mixed with the other stuff, like, it kind of has that sound to it. So That's how I felt about the early Thursday stuff too. But yeah, like I said, this is a decent song, but not as good as the first track.
Well, all the bands that we've mentioned so far exactly have the problem where they sort of came out of the gate dramatic and heavy and then tried to chase a dollar or something.
Yes, yes, yes.
And Shift probably worst of all. I think that they went so far afield of what made them good.
Yeah.
There was no coming back.
Shift had a rapcore song on their demo too.
Their demo's hard.
Yeah. Yeah. I forget what it's like. It's almost like a Method of Groove. Oh, fuck, it's bothering me that I can't think of it. But it has like... It's like, it does have lyrics like we're the tough crew and we're gonna fuck you up, and it's like I don't know. Wish I could remember. I'm sure I could consult YouTube later though.
Well, everyone take a break because it's out there. It's got if you find the Shift record with the graffiti font on the cover, you're on the right track. So you're exactly right. This beginning of this was drifting kind of far afield of my tastes in post hardcore, and you know, in the early days of post hardcore, the world was trying to get me to listen to Sensefield, and I wasn't falling for that shit. And then they put like a Snapcase looking album cover on that Knapsack record. I wasn't falling for that shit either. Texas Is the Reason way later. They're just the Smashing Pumpkins. I didn't fall for that. And, you know, there's a lot of bands who were doing that. They're just sort of like hiding indie rock in the hardcore scene. And I think about half of the songs infected by that. And, you know, but they bail out. You know, I think they bail it out. The singer hovers a little too long on notes that I don't think he's hitting. And I think that works. It's a little bit desperate sounding. My guy in the bass is still going for it. He's just hammering away. And I think he's the reason it sounds dramatic. I think he's the reason that there's like a lot of tension. So when it's getting a little bit too alt rock, he comes bashing through with his bulldozer and makes it tense. And there's a whole experimental ending. After the song is good for about a minute, there's this experimental ending where I guess they couldn't afford to make the joke where they tell the engineer to turn the tape off. So it goes, ew. Every band makes that joke when you recorded back in the day. So they just play the song as though that's happening. They just keep slowing as though the song is slowly dying. I think that's top notch. I think this song is it brought me back from the brink.
So then you flip it over and you got this sad, lonely song by itself, Ramada Inn. I think this would be the radio song, but radio existed for 1995 rough emo core. It has a more direct approach. It's more, even though I don't think this dude knows how to write an actual chorus, it does have a chorus verse chorus verse or verse chorus verse first chorus pattern. The chorus is just this guy still just saying stuff though. There's no like actual singing along. It's fine with me. Like I said, catchy, not poppy. That's fine with me. But he could have gave the people something to bite onto, but he didn't. They didn't even include an insert. He doesn't want people to know his lyrics, so it makes sense. But they do bury deep in this after a couple verse choruses. They bury in like a more difficult part to digest, and it's cool. It's like a more rocking out guitar work part, and then they go back in the chorus and they do another rocking out part. It's pretty simple compared to the other two songs. Like I said, it's more of a radio track, but it's great. I loved it. I love this whole record. But that first song really shines out of all of them.
This song is ambitious. And whenever we see that a whole side of a record is one song, it usually means they blew it. these guys stuck all their ideas into this track as though it was their last chance. This is the Eminem moment. This is their last chance. And it feels kind of almost 8 minutes long because it goes so many places.
Yeah.
So I think they cracked it. I think they cracked the one song per side code. We get some unexpected effects on the vocals,
yes,
which are also multi-layered, like lots and lots of different vocal experiments are going on.
Yeah, I didn't even mention that part because it sounds like shit, honestly. Like, yeah, I could tell they had like real high hopes for that, and it just, I didn't want to embarrass them, but it sounds like shit.
They gave it a shot. They gave it a shot.
They gave it a shot.
It gave it some texture, some needed texture. There's big dramatic key changes. There's rhythm changes. There's tension. There's release. I think that this is the Bohemian Rhapsody of post-hardcore. This is the most ambitious. This is the most anyone's done with a post-hardcore song that I can think of this era of post-hardcore. And I think they cracked the code of this guitar sound too, because if you spend 4 minutes just sort of slashing away at these dramatic chords, it doesn't matter how you set your amp. You could play this song through a transistor radio and it's going to sound fine because you're just kind of like, yeah, you know, just playing the chords. And the bass is even chilled out because he probably had tendonitis from the other two songs. So he knew they were going to stick this landing with no trouble at all. I think there's nothing else anyone could do with this genre. They did it.
So there you go. That's the self-titled Farkas Affair record. Now it's time for me to put a little rating on this. My ratings go from throw it in the trash, don't ever bother with it, to just stream it, you don't need to own it, to pick it up in the bargain bin, to buy it for full price or buy it for collector's prices. I was genuinely surprised by how good I thought this record was, aside from the production, but what are you going to do? It's 1995. This is the first band I think on the show where, I mean, besides Vent, but this is like, yeah, I think Vent's up there too, but this is the first band where it's real unfortunate they have this in a split record and that's it. And maybe a comp track too, but I don't think it's always dicey with comps on Discogs, but they might have a comp track too, but it's kind of a bummer these guys didn't get to have like a big LP with a great production or anything like that. Obviously there's still garden variety that you can go back to, but yeah, this is a real good hidden gem. I can't go complete correct collector's prices because I judge the full package, and I think this record is a little too mysterious. There's no real connection for anybody. You pick this up and you're just getting some three tracks, not much else. And yeah, so I can't go full collector's prices, but this is highly recommended. This is definitely a full price record for me. If you have any kind of affinity for that kind of late 90s, mid to late 90s, even to early 2000s kind of emo rock, a lot of post-hardcore, like a lot less polished than the stuff that would come to the early to mid 2000s, like the bands we said, like Early Thursday, Shift, even Quicksand, throw them in there. I would even throw in like another Long Island band like On the Might of Princes. Like if any of that stuff was your shit or still is your shit and you haven't heard this band, I would rush out and pick up this record for a full price.
I think these guys shot themselves in the foot with this dumb band name. aside from the fact that we found other bands named Farkas Affair, Scut Farkas Affair, Scud Farkas Affair, yeah, there's nobody can agree on that kid's name or the spelling, and it's too cute by half to name yourself after a Christmas movie, unless you've gotten away with something earlier to earn that. and then once you realize that a vague name is referencing something like that, it's kind of annoying. Like Super Touch is the same way.
What's Super Touch reference?
Oh, well, yeah, see, right? It sounds like some kind of spiritual thing or some Krishna thing or something like that. It's a toy. It's one of those, remember Super Jock?
Yeah.
Like the guy who just kicks a football? Super Touch was the basketball guy. So he's like this Fisher-Price looking 70s toy that shoots a basketball, which is nothing wrong with that, but that's not what I thought that they were talking about.
Not me either. Wow, that's crazy.
Yeah, so like, you know, in a world where these guys were named Burn or Shift or something, I think we'd be seeing a reunion tour if they had picked a better name. I'll be curious to hear some follow-up from Jeff. I'd love to hear follow-up because I want to know, like, why are these guys so fully formed and mature sounding? Like, they have a real idea of what they're supposed to sound like. They seem to be referenced in all these other interviews about the old days by all these other bands. Nobody's ever heard of this band. No one talks about this record other than those, like, you just see them on the periphery of things. Why has no one heard of this? Because I think this record's really good.
Yeah.
I think they handle like the melodrama better than any other second or third tier band of this genre that I can name. I can't think of anybody who's below the top like five who's any good, let alone pretty good. And they're close to getting my perfect score. The lack of energy in the packaging, you can't get a perfect score with this record cover. You can't. So the Farkas Affair gets a 4.5 Red Ryder BB guns out of 5. Still not bad. Yeah. It would have been a 5. It would have been an easy 5.
Yeah, maybe that's why they broke up, because they just they realized they failed the public.
Yeah.
By not including an insert. But thanks, Jeff, for recommending this. This was definitely a great listen. And 34 episodes, this is at least in the top 3, so you got that. But if you guys want to reach out to us with your requests, no requests too big or small. There is requests that are too expensive, though, so we'll see. But you can reach out to us. First 7-Inch Club, just type that into the internet, and you're going to get two things. You're going to get our social media, and you're going to get the song by Fall Silent that I stole the name from. So you can figure out which one's which and reach out to us. Until then, I think as long as he doesn't bitch out, he doesn't chicken out or anything, we're gonna have another special guest next week. Yes. So stay tuned for a special guest next week.
And if you do recommend something really expensive, just do what that other guy did and send us a really sketchy.
Yeah.
Use a VPN so you're safe, and send us a really unpleasant looking email with a bunch of attachments that we're afraid to open.
Yeah, do that.
Bomb rush. What you gonna do when I take out your heart?